Get ready to whiten those knuckles and hold fast as we talk the most dangerous, daring, and epic sea stories ever told.
Whether facing ruthless men who prey on other mariners, or storms that turn calm seas into graveyards, those who go down to the sea and cast off lines enter the most challenging and dangerous environment on Earth.
Only here will you hear their stories and the lessons gained through their experience. I'm your host, Phil.
And I'm Bill.
And we welcome you aboard They Had to Go Out podcast. Before we dive into this episode, we need to provide a disclaimer. The views expressed on this podcast are those of the individuals involved and are not to be construed as official or reflecting the views of any government agency or military service. This podcast is an independent effort with no government association.
When the most is expected, the brave men and women of the U.S. Coast Guard are always ready. The National Coast Guard Museum will engage, educate, and inspire visitors by honoring the courage and skill of our nation's unsung armed service. The museum will explore the Coast Guard's rich history and current impact through interactive exhibits, STEM-based learning experiences, and leadership development programming. Find out how you can join the effort. Become a plank owner today. Visit CoastGuardMuseum.org/out. That's CoastGuardMuseum.org/OUT.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Had to Go Out podcast. Thank you guys for joining us. Thanks for subscribing, liking, sharing, giving those 5-star reviews, and helping us get the word out about the National Coast Guard Museum. Really appreciate all of our new followers ever since the quarantine. Hope everyone's staying healthy, and hope this gives you a reason to stay inside and contribute to making this thing go away. And who we've got on the line today, referred to me by a shared friend of ours, an HSC down in Key West right now. We've got Mrs. Christine Angel Hughes, born and raised in New York, or actually born in New York, raised in New Jersey. Was the 2008 class at Jacksonville University, then a 2009 graduate of Officer Candidate School. Went from there to flight school in Pensacola. First operational assignment with the Coast Guard was Air Station Miami. Got her wings on the HC-144 CASA, Ocean Sentry, and I got that completely wrong when I was talking to her. pretty much called it every airframe, but what it actually is. So that's one that we have not had on the show before, and very stoked to hear about it. But I went from Miami to ATC Mobile on the operations side, and then back to Air Station Miami where she is now. And with that, Mrs. Hughes, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
No, thanks for coming on. I know that you just had a new baby. Just want to say congratulations publicly.
Thank you. Thank you so much. She's 4 months old, and she's also on the call. So if you hear a little giggle or something, that's
awesome. Good to have her on board. Well, Mrs. Hughes, what is your most dangerous, daring, or epic sea story or stories?
All right. I'd say my most epic sea story occurred back in 2017. I was actually pregnant with my second child at the time, and it was actually my last operational flight, or my last duty flight, before I was going to be grounded for the rest of my pregnancy and then go on maternity leave. So we're on duty, and part of the HC-144, the CASA crew. We normally fly with a crew of 6 people. So that includes 2 pilots, 2 mission sensor operators. You know, they're on the radars and also the FLIR. And then we have the 2 crewmen in the back. One is the drop master, and the other one is the basic air crewman.
Okay, so you got to totally explain the CASA to me. So I get it. So the crew makes a little sense to me. I kind of understand what missions it's running a little bit now. But what's like its primary role out there?
All right. The HC-144, it's a medium range surveillance platform type of aircraft compared to the C-130, which is a long range. That just means the C-130 can stay out longer and fly further than we can.
What's your duration, or what are the operational limits of the CASA?
The CASA, we burn about 1,000 pounds an hour, and we could fly nonstop 9 hours, and that's from, you know, if we fill the aircraft up with as much fuel as possible, and you know, we land with like 0 pounds, which we would never do. But
oh, I thought you were gonna be like, and here comes the story.
You're right. Oh, absolutely not. No, we'll get in trouble for that. But our regulations, you know, we need to be on deck with at least an hour's worth of fuel. So if we were still pushing
8 hours, like
easily 8 hours. And I've done 8 hours on cases, and so have my colleagues, and then we'll come back, get some more fuel, and then, you know, fly for another 6-7 hours, you know, whatever the case calls for.
Well, and so we talked about like how the CASA kind of came to be, I guess. Could you share that with the mm-hmm. audience? So I assumed when I first started talking to you, I had seen a photo, right, of you walking away from an aircraft, and I totally thought that it was the Spartan, but I was completely wrong, and you schooled me. And then I was like, oh, so it's a C-130, but no, I was wrong again. So how did the Coast Guard come about these, and then where are they at?
Okay, so before the CASAs came online, the only operational fixed-wing aircraft the Coast Guard had were the C-130s. So the C-130s, they were, you know, getting kind of old and outdated. So the Coast Guard figured, hey, we should probably get a new fixed wing platform, something to serve our needs. And the Falcon jets, the A-225s, the CASAs are the Falcon jets replacement.
So you guys are like the executive shuttle force for the Commandant. No, I'm just kidding. That was a joke.
No, that's the G5. No,
oh, I was wrong on that one too. God, yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I know nothing about aviation. So sad.
Oh, no. The Gucci jet. Yeah,
the Gucci G5. Jet. Yeah. So you guys aren't flying. You don't have the executive suite package in there, huh?
No. The G5s, the Gulfstream 5s, they're up in D.C. And, you know, I don't consider them operational, obviously, because they have a very special mission, you know, VIP transport.
Right. So do you guys run, is it primarily search and rescue, or is it, you know, a combination of all service missions? What's your primary role?
Yeah. It's a combination of the Coast Guard's mission. So primarily search and rescue. But also we do law enforcement, just like, you know, all the other platforms. And with the fixed wing side, with the C-144, since we're a cargo type of aircraft, we can configure for logistics flights and medevacs.
Yeah, which is a huge upgrade over the other platform you talked about.
The Falcon jet. Really small.
I've seen because the Falcon's got that little porthole in the very bottom, right?
Yes, it does.
Yeah,
very,
that's it.
Very tiny.
Yeah.
So the Falcon jet, they'll get on scene really quickly. You know, it's a jet. So they'll get there, but their capability to loiter and stick around wasn't ideal for the Coast Guard's mission. So the
8 hour CASA duration or endurance that you guys have out there. Where are you at? Where are they located? Like what air stations?
The CASAs are at Air Station Miami or mm-hmm. down in Miami, Florida. They're up in Mobile, Alabama, at ATC.
Okay.
They are also in Corpus Christi, Texas, and Cape Cod, Massachusetts.
Yeah, so pretty much all over the country. Just none, no West Coast, huh?
No West Coast. No, yeah. They threw the long range, you know, boys out there. Obviously, the Pacific is, you know, it's a pretty big ocean.
So, but you guys could make it to like San Juan easily, right?
Yeah. And that's we do that. Yeah, normally out of Air Station Miami, and it's kind of our deal.
Yeah, same as the cutters. It just takes you 8 hours versus 8 days. I get it.
Yep.
All right, ma'am. So I'll let you carry on the story. Thanks for explaining that to us.
Okay. Oh, no worries. So back to our duty night back in 2017. This is my last flight before I'm grounded for maternity purposes, and we get a call. It's after 10 o'clock. And It was for an overdue boater. And initially, I just gather up all the details, like I normally would do, myself and the other pilot. We acquired the search plan from Sector, and you know, it was in a very distinct spot. And so we take off, and before we take off, you know, I insist that I always just my own thing as an aircraft commander, and you know, with my experience, I always like to know, you know, at what time did the initial call come in, and you know, what was the last known position for the boater. And so I was able to get those last two bits of information right before we took off, and I noticed that his last known position wasn't at the in our search area. And so I was like, well, you know what, I want to fly over his last known position, and then, you know, give it a nice good, you know, quick sweep, a nice little search, and then we'll proceed on to our assigned search area.
Solid call. Everyone take note of that if you're out there running SAR right now, because yeah, the computer gets it right sometimes, right?
Solid
advice, ma'am.
Exactly. And that's exactly what it was. So we went out, and last known position was, there was a couple of little islands, you know, shallow water. And, you know, by now it's close to midnight, and, you know, just shallow water. And, you know, asked my FLIR operators or my MSOs to, you know, really, you know, get the camera on there and give the shorelines a nice thorough sweep, and then we'll continue on to our search area. And you know, what do you know? and myself and the other pilot, we had night vision goggles on up front, and I just happened to see some irregular flashing, like a beacon or like a strobe, but it was irregular, kind of like, you know, it didn't follow a pattern like a buoy would, or just even a regular strobe light. It was just, you know, erratic pattern that drew my attention. And it was the boater. It was him signaling us with his, I think he had a little flashlight.
The freak out pattern, right?
That's the freak out pattern.
This is my chance. Now I'm going to do whatever I can to get their attention.
Exactly. It wasn't, you know, like Morse code, like, nope, the freak out pattern. Yep. And that's the best pattern to have. Like, you don't want to keep it, you know, constant, because it could, there's a lot of, you know, anyone that's out on the water, like, you know, there's beacons, there's lots of stuff that have regular flashing patterns.
Yeah. And you guys are flying at what, when you sight that?
We're at 1500 feet.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's, you know, it goes to show it works, right? Yeah. Cause even flying at 1500 feet. Yeah. He got you. That's awesome.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, spotted him down there, and we couldn't talk to him on the radios because his radios were, his radios were fried, and he was there just drifting in the water. You know, he didn't have any power, so automatically assumed, hey, he's probably his battery or his engine is probably dead, and you know, he can't go anywhere. He's disabled.
Right.
The vessel is disabled, not him. So at that point, we, decided, I said, okay, let's go ahead and let's drop this guy a radio so we can communicate with him. And, you know, with our Coast Guard training, we want to assess, make sure he's all right, see if there's anyone else on board, and, you know, all the while trying to coordinate a small boat to go pick him up. Or even a good Samaritan, whoever's nearby, just, you know, trying to get him some help, get him out of the water.
Ma'am, I'm so intrigued because I always wondered how those conversations went. Like, when the aircraft, you know, who even makes the call whether or not to drop something? So you're totally cluing us in right now.
Oh, yeah. So it's, well, you know, crew resource management, we use the crew, but, you know, the aircraft commander is, you know, ultimately, you know, in charge. We say the aircraft commander has 51% of the vote.
Nice. I thought you were going to say God. I was just going to go with it.
Oh, no.
that's what I thought was coming.
Oh, no. so 51% of the vote, or, you know, whatever the action's going to be, usually, you know, the aircraft commander will bring it up, make a suggestion, and, you know, how I run my, you know, my missions is, you know, I throw an idea out there and then, you know, I ask the other pilot, hey, what do you think? You know, we should drop this guy a radio. What do you think? And, you know, aircraft or the co-pilot would, you know, give me their two cents. And then, you know, I'll go back to the crew, you know, drop master, basic air crewman, MSOs, like everyone, you know, has a say so. And we briefed that before the flight. If you think it's going to be unsafe or if it's, you know, if it's not practical or practical, just, you know, speak up, sure. You know, say something. So, it was our decision to go ahead to drop him a radio to see what's going on.
And how does the radio drop?
Oh, the cargo door in the back, the little ramp, we open that in flight.
And there's like a red light, I guess, that goes off, right? That tells everybody, like, hey, cargo door's open?
Well, we have checklists, so we're all, we all have internal communication, you know, in our headsets inside the aircraft. So, you know, when I talk, everybody can hear each other.
Okay.
So, so we don't need a light, you know, like if we had like power jumpers or, you know, folks jumping out of the back of the aircraft, obviously.
Does that happen? Is the Coast Guard deploying para jumpers out the back?
Oh yeah.
Really?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah. Wow. Yeah.
I mean, you know, what's funny is like when I Googled image the CASA, right? The first thing I thought of was a jump plane. That's what it looks like. It looks like the planes that they use to, you know, herd everybody up there and jump out of.
We do the air shows and also jumpers from all the services. They need their jump quals and training, so you know we'll serve as a jumping platform for those guys.
All the services except for our own.
Except for our own, yeah.
Right. Just got to throw that out there.
Exactly. So back to the story. So yeah, so we would coordinate via checklist, you know, to get the cargo door open. It's one big synchronized, organized dance that we have going on inside of the flight deck. So everyone's on the same page. We're talking, and you know, so we run through the checklist to open up the crew door, or I'm sorry, the cargo door or the cargo ramp. And yeah, they can open a cargo door from the back, or we can also, we also have the button up front in the flight deck.
And what, so is it, it's just connected to a parachute, I guess, right? I mean, the parachute, is it, I heard from a C-130 pilot one time, they just eyeball it. Like they fly kind of on a line to him and then just say go. Yep. Is that the same thing?
Yep. Exact same thing. Yep. Open the door and then the drop master and the basic air crewman, they're back there. And yeah, I just fly over it and then I'm eyeballing it. And once I get to my, you know, my practiced position or my, you know, my comfortable line of sight, I say drop, drop, drop. And they just push it out the back of the aircraft.
Hmm. You know what, I wonder what it's like on a Falcon. Could you imagine like jet engines spooling up? And yeah, but you're like,
oh my gosh.
Could you imagine what airspeed are those guys going when they dump something?
Oh my gosh. And they're, you know, the fact that, you know, not only are they, you know, probably a lot quicker, because, you know, we'll execute the drops at 120 knots, which, you know, is probably, what was that?
It still sounds incredibly fast.
Right. Yeah. So the Falcon, you know, had comparable speeds, but I'm, you know, they're probably maybe 10 knots faster if I had to guess.
Yeah.
Because, you know, just aerodynamics, the shorter wingspan and the jet engines, they can't go that slow without, you know, falling out of the sky. I can't believe the Falcon jets did the same mission as us, because they didn't have night vision goggles back then.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So imagine just pitch black over, you know, the open waters. It's pitch black. And they're flying, you know, 1,500 feet or below, because we do our drops at 200 feet.
Right.
So
that's crazy. And then
200 feet, you can't see anything. That's wild to me.
Yeah, and if people have never been on the ocean, I mean, if there's no moon out, right, it is black.
Right.
It's blacker.
Right.
Than, I mean, you can't see anything. There's no, that's crazy. Yeah, I can't imagine flying blind like that.
Exactly. And this is kind of like how my drop was. There was no moon. It was pitch black, and I could only see the boat, you know, when he would turn his flashlight on. And so
really
was,
no light, right? Because, I mean, the NVGs
no
need ambient light just to pick up the...
Exactly.
Yeah, Crazy.
Yep, it magnifies any tiny piece of light it has to give us a picture. But when there's no light, then yeah, it's might as well just close my eyes.
Right. So how close did the drop master get it?
Yeah, so he was good. He was right on. We had to do a couple of passes because first spotted him, we were at 1500. So by the time we run through our checklist, and I'm just trying to do practice runs around him now down at 200 feet. And
how'd you let him know that you saw, like, you started orbiting him, I guess, or do you like dip the wings? How does that go? Even though it's night.
Yeah, so it's dark. So yeah, we come down and we call it, I guess the term would be zooming, but it's kind of like we fly directly over him, low altitude, and, flash our landing lights on, like, hey, we see you, and fly directly over him at nighttime.
Yeah, you buzz the tower.
Yep, we buzz the tower, nice. Pretty much.
Okay, cool.
Yeah,
awesome.
We wake him up, so when we get down real low, our big old engines, you can hear that, and, so we have our
what a cool feeling that must be, huh? Like sitting on the boat. Have you ever heard, I'm assuming people have done little passes over you during training, right? Have you ever heard it?
Passes over me or during training? No.
Yeah, just
no, passes over me.
Well, no, I mean, if you were on the runway or whatever and you hear him come by.
Oh, yeah. Flybys,
yeah.
Flyovers. I love those.
It's got to be a cool feeling.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I love those. Even on the ground. That's awesome.
All right. So he's got the radio.
So it took a few passes around. So, we're at 200 feet and like I said, it's dark. So my night vision goggles, I can't see him. So if I can't see him, then it's hard for me to time it when to, tell the drop masters to drop. So we did probably five laps around this guy. And I was like, all right, we're just, I'm just going to have to, try to gauge it. I use my, my FLIR operators because, they can see the boat obviously on their screens using the FLIR. And I'm just like, hey, you guys let me know if we're lined up and I'm just going to make the call. And we did. And that was my, I'd say my most challenging drop because I was blind. It was dark and, it was a perfect drop. He got it. So he was able to reel in the radio. And he spoke to us and he said, yeah, he's been adrift for 3 days and he's slightly delusional. He has no food. He's just, he doesn't know if he's coming or if he's going. And and one of my drop master, he actually had a brilliant idea to put strobes, just a little strobe light, not a strobe light, a chem light on the back of or attached to the package. So, to help the small boat, find him easier.
Right.
And that's, he did that, put the strobe or put the chem light, on his deck because he didn't have any lights, he didn't have any battery power. So he's just completely dark, a darkened ship out there. And,
what were his first words to you over the radio? Do you remember?
He sounded a bit, maybe aloof. Like spaced out almost.
Right.
Cause he said he hadn't eaten in days and, he was delusional. So, so he sounded a little bit out of it. So it wasn't like he's like, oh, hey, Coast Guard, thank you. Like, nah,
right.
He's like, yeah, I've been here for 3 days and,
I get it. Uh-huh. The memoir really quick. Like, here's the sob story. Help me out. That's good.
Yep. So, yeah, small boat scooped him up a couple hours later, and he was back on shore.
Very cool, man.
Mississippi.
I love hearing the mechanics of how that all went down.
It was a blast. I really, it was very rewarding for my entire crew because everyone played a role, the MSOs with the cameras, helping me navigate, and obviously the drop master and the BA with their ideas, and not all drop masters are created equally because when you say drop
I didn't say it
just like I'm pretty, not all BMs are created equally.
Yeah, we're just at a higher level than everyone else, so no one notices the bad ones.
Exactly. So that one was especially rewarding because every position played a vital role.
Yeah,
and success of the mission.
Everything went right, right? I mean, you searched outside of your assigned area. You found him despite no ambient light, and you were able to do the drop in near total darkness.
Yes.
Awesome. Awesome, yes, man. Great story.
No problem.
Well, let's go way back to why you joined the Coast Guard out of Jacksonville, U.
All right. Jacksonville, I was a flight major, an aviation major. So I learned how to fly all civilian side. And when I graduated, I was working as a flight instructor. So I was teaching other folks how to fly, building my hours, and, you know, was eventually training towards an airline job. Well, you know, 2008. Came along the great recession of our time. Well, I guess this whole COVID-19 is about to be
just trumped it. Fair enough.
Yeah. Every time I'm ready to enter the civilian sector, it's, God, maybe I just need to stay in for like
maybe
30
it's
years.
Destined. It could just be destined. Yeah.
I just need to just never leave the Coast Guard. That's it. So yeah, 2008, the, you know, great recession of my time. So, the economy was in the pits. All of my pilot friends, the ones that had graduated, you know, a year, 2 years before me, they were all furloughed. So there's kind of like what's going on right now. Just a bunch of pilots. Demand's not there. Folks are afraid to fly, or folks don't have money to fly. So, you know, I was faced with a decision. It's like, you know, I can either leave flying alone, take a break from flying, and maybe explore the business portion of my degree, mm-hmm. Just so I can have a, you know, a job to pay the bills, or, you know, perhaps I can become a military pilot and, you know, use my flying skills that I have already towards, you know, something that I never would have imagined, you know, just flying for my country, essentially. And I went to all the recruiters, Coast Guard, Navy, Army, Marine Corps, Air Force, and I loved the Coast Guard's pitch the best.
What about the pitch got you?
They said we save lives, we don't take lives.
I was going to say, I know it wasn't the money. There's no way it was the money.
Oh, no, and that was the hardest thing. Oh my gosh, the Army was like, boom, sign-on bonus, $20,000, and we'll pay your student loans. And you know, Jacksonville, I have some pretty good student loans.
Right.
And all the services, you know, had some type of, you know, student loan repayment program except the Coast Guard.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, oh, man. But, you know, for me, it's all about quality of life. For me, even back when I was, you know, 22 years old, I was like, you know what? Looking at the quality of life of, you know, like, for example, the naval pilots or the pilots in the Navy, you know, compared to the Coast Guard, I was like, oof, man, you know, the Coast Guard's nice. You get these nice air stations that are along the coast someplace. And the type of pilot I wanted to be was, you know, cargo transport type pilot. So, you know, flying fighter jets was, you know, I never had a real desire to do that. So it was a no-brainer. Coast Guard, you know, saving lives, that's very rewarding. And the fact that I'll always have a mission in the Coast Guard during peacetime or wartime.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, the duality, right, of the new purpose you found in life. Very cool.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
We've got a lot more of this episode to go, and we'll get right back to it after this short ad from our sponsor. We're going to give you a key number about the future National Coast Guard Museum, and that number is 5.
There are 5 themed storylines: lifesavers around the globe, enforcers on the seas, defenders of our nation, champions of commerce, and protectors of the environment.
The exhibits and galleries in those storylines will be showcased in a 5-story museum.
And here's our favorite 5. For as little as $5 a month, you can be a plank owner and support construction of the National Coast Guard Museum.
For details on how you can get involved, go to coastguardmuseum.org/out. That's coastguardmuseum.org/OUT. An awesome story. I was curious. I like how you threw out their pitch. I always kind of wondered how did they get you? That's good.
Oh man.
Yeah. what about flight school? So once you got in, you know, you said you were a flight instructor before, and now you're back as a student. Were the differences? How did it go?
Yeah. So I, you know, right before I joined the Coast Guard, I had amassed about, you know, just under 1,000 hours of flight time. And so I went into,
that's a good number, right? I mean, that's quite a few. Yeah.
So I had all this experience, you know, I'm teaching folks how to fly. And so, you know, I was like, I should be able to, you know, go through Navy flight school, you know, without any problems. So I thought, I think the most challenging part of Navy flight school was just the ground portion. So before we hit the flight line, we have 6 weeks of ground school. Now I equate this 6 weeks of ground school to like my 4-year degree in aviation.
Nice.
So it's all condensed, and just the way the military, you know, does things and teaches, you know, different concepts was completely foreign to the way I had learned. So my learning curve came, you know, in the classroom on the ground. So I was able to eventually get through that, and you know, once I hit the flight line, it was smooth sailing from there, because just flying an airplane, maneuvers, you know, I had a little bit of an edge up on my classmates, you know, because they had never flown before.
Did you show off? Like, what was the show off move? You had to have a show off move. Don't all pilots like have some kind of signature move?
No, not in the training environment.
No, you can't bust the tower in the training environment. Not in NAS Pensacola.
Oh, you better not. Oh my gosh. And this was what, back in 2000, I started flight school just after 2010. January of 2010. And attrition, we used to say, you know, my other fellow, naval aviators, attrition is the goal or something like
right,
that, but
yeah.
they were letting pilots go, you know, off of any incident, or, you know, so especially something reckless, like doing your own move, like, no way.
Nope. Man.
No way. It's
not World War II anymore, huh?
But exactly. No. So like, just stick to the syllabus, you know?
And what were you guys flying there?
So my class was the first class in Pensacola to fly the T-6, which is the newer trainer coming off of the T-34.
So like single engine propeller?
You know, single engine, yep, turboprop, 2,000 horsepower. So still the same concept as T-34, but, you know, we had ejection seats and...
that's a plus, right? Just in case.
So capable of pulling more G's and you know, flying with a G suit. And later on in my career, you know, as I'm flying in the Caribbean, the Dominican Republic, their fighter jet is basically a T-6.
Oh wow! Yeah,
that was pretty cool. Yeah, and I was like, "Oh man, look at this!"
Yeah, I can command this whole Air Force.
Yeah, I know, right?
That's awesome.
Yep. So yeah, the T-6 is a great bird to learn how to fly, and just going through each phase. You know, I still learned with every flight. It's not like I just went in there and, you know, I didn't have to study, but you know, the tandem seating was different. You know, the one in front of each other was different for me. Aerobatics was completely new to me. Formation flying, completely new to me. So the only thing I really was like comfortable in was the instrument phase, which is just flying, looking at your instruments. So, you know, not looking outside.
VFR suspended, right. Is that what they call that? I'm just spitballing. See, I watched the Kobe Bryant thing. I knew what happened, you know?
Oh, my God. You see them, those helicopter pilots, I tell you.
Yeah.
but it's IFR.
IFR. Yeah, I went with an auxiliary pilot one time, and he told me that we were like in VFR rules, and then just stop looking at the dash altogether. I think, or I don't remember which way he said it, but I got a little concerned. I was like, wait a minute, what are we doing?
What's going on here?
So, why'd you turn off the GPS, bro? Turn it back on.
Look outside. Open your eyes. Back to your initial flying. You look outside and figure out where you're going. Navigate. You got your charts or your maps. And you navigate using your resources. You're outside.
I can just picture the trainer like, this is how real pilots fly or something, something crazy.
It's so different. Just being just military flight school versus my civilian training. Like, it's just like night and day. And a lot of it just has to do with the mentality. But I understand, military, they're training us and then we're going to go out and execute these missions like, life or death. Almost immediately after we graduate. So I understand there's a lot of seriousness that goes along with military aviation.
But you still have a block of instruction called acrobatics.
Yeah.
What does that entail? I'm just curious. You hooked me now. I'm just curious.
Acrobatics, it's what you see on TV or the air show, the spins, the loops, pulling G's. The dynamic maneuvering
I get it. That's the that sounds like the professional term for it. Dynamic maneuvering.
It's the bow rolls, the aileron rolls that we do, loops, the split S, MOMN, like all the when kids are playing video games, a lot of kids, every little kid wants to be a fighter pilot because that's the that's the fun part, I guess.
What's the closest video game to real life?
Back when I was playing video games, before I was...
You got kids now, ma'am. You'll be there soon enough. But it's going to be way cooler, It's going to be like... It's going to be just some kind of virtual reality goggle when they're flying.
Probably. I play Call of Duty now. That's my jam.
Nice.
But for like flying games, back when I was... before I was a professional pilot, back in my day, we're doing computer games. So, computer games, I say F-22 Raptor, and also Flight Simulator, Microsoft's Flight Simulator.
I'm going to go with F-22 Raptor. I can't. Microsoft's Flight Simulator is too close to the real thing. Like, who cares at that point?
Right. Oh, so you know about it. Yeah. Microsoft Flight. I tell them.
I sat down one time, like, is this a game? What is this? Like, I don't
know. No, it's real life flying. Yeah. I've had students, on the civilian side that, I can tell that they go home, I would give them.
That's bad. I know where that you're like. No, I can tell that they're getting their tips from video games.
No, but it's so realistic. But they actually, those that have these, the Microsoft Simulator, they come in. They perform better than the folks that don't have a game, because they can sit there and actually fly the entire flight. They can do startup checklists. They can push switches and take off, land, talk to tower, like, it's so realistic. It's not even like a game, really.
Yeah, it's totally not like a game. It's boring. No.
It is right. Boring. For, if you're looking for a quick thrill,
I want to shoot missiles and fly through, like,
F-22 right there. Yep.
Right, yeah. Fly through flak and stuff,
Yes. Yeah, you need to get F-22 Raptor, yep.
So how do you get assigned to the CASA? How does that work?
Okay, so you go into a flight school. So we check in at all the coasties. We all start off in Pensacola. Once you get to Pensacola, we have a Coast Guard liaison officer. It's an 06 because, we go to Navy flight school, so it's under Naval Command. But, so the coasties were kind of handled by our Coast Guard liaison officer. So as soon as you check in, he would ask, and mine was Captain Berghorn. He asked, okay, do you want a fixed wing or rotary? And this is back in 2000. I just checked in 2010. I said fixed wing. He was like, excellent, perfect. You can expect that. Because, majority of the aviators in the Coast Guard, they all want to fly helicopters.
Right.
So fixed wing wasn't popular. No one cared about it. And he was like, great. So yeah, I was pretty much trekking towards fixed wing, and I had zero problems getting it. Now, on the flip side, those that, you know, I've had several classmates that wanted to fly helicopters, but, you know, there's only so many helicopter spots. So they were forced to go fixed wing. And the way you can assure you get the platform you want, you just have to perform well in flight school in that beginning portion. So
they rank order you, I guess, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
So by your score. Yep. So do well, you know, ace all your tests, you know, the physical side and the academic side, and just, you know, just be top of your game. And, you know, and then number one gets to choose what they want. Number two gets to choose number three, number four, and kind of like that.
Very cool. And I mean, all air stations are in pretty decent locations, so it's not like you're going to go anywhere that bad, I wouldn't think.
Right. Right. Well, I heard Detroit is kind of,
I didn't say it again. Yeah, Detroit's a little rough.
That's what I hear from my Hilo friends.
It's frozen. Like, I mean, what more do you need to know? It's freezing.
Oh my gosh, that doesn't sound cool at all.
No,
I'd rather go to the Pacific Northwest before the Middle America. But
for sure.
But I digress.
Well, so once you graduate and you earn your wings at school, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you get to your first assignment in Miami, and is there a break-in process? Are you immediately in flight status? How does that whole thing work? Like, what's day one like, I guess?
Day one, okay. So I graduated fixed wing aviators. We finished up our training in Corpus Christi, Texas. And the helicopter folks, they do all of their training in Pensacola. But anyway, so we graduate from Navy flight school. And so now we're newly minted naval aviators. And then we go to our respective units. So the day I showed up and checked into Miami was actually the Falcon Jets' last flight.
Oh, wow.
In Miami. Yeah, so it was pretty cool.
You know, with the recessions and then events like that happening on, you know, similar events in your life, that probably means you're destined to do this job for the duration. Just saying.
My goodness. This is, yeah.
Just saying.
I can't. Oh my gosh. You're probably right. So I show up and, you know, just check in. And since, you know, I haven't flown, you know, the new, you know, we just graduated from, you know, whatever aircraft we're flying under the Naval Command. So we still have to get trained in our Coast Guard specific aircraft.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So it's we basically show up, typically show up at your unit, and basically you can't fly until you go to what I call Coast Guard flight school. Our schoolhouse, which is up in Mobile, ATC Mobile. And so I show up depending on how much time. I was able to get an earlier slot to ATC Mobile because I don't know how it all worked out. Like, the guy that was supposed to go before me, and I showed up, they were, all the Falcon Jet pilots were now transitioning over to the CASA. So all of those cats were heading up to Mobile. So I was kind of like last on the list because I just showed up, and, you know, I'm not even type rated in any Coast Guard aircraft.
Right.
So yeah, I just stood like desk duty. They teach you we call ODO, operations duty officer, you know, answering like the phones.
Welcome to the fleet.
Welcome to the fleet. Yep. Hey, let's get you trained on this desk. So yeah, I did a couple of, you know, ODO duties. And then I went off to ATC Mobile, and I was there for about 3 months, learning how to fly the CASA. And then out of ATC, I was, you know, officially winged or graduated as a HC-144 co-pilot. And then once I got back to Miami, boom, they send you off on a deployment, you know, as quickly as possible. So you can, you know, get comfortable with the plane, get familiar, and not be distracted with all the collaterals and, you know, just like the office work that, you know, the officers also have to do.
What's the deployment? So are you guys going to forward air bases, like Bahamas kind of thing?
So for a fixed winger out of Miami, we stage out of Gitmo or Puerto Rico.
Oh, yeah. That's, I mean, that's, yeah, removing you from bad. Everything. Yeah, okay.
Yep. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, right. Yeah. So nice. we'll go down range. In the
Which
Caribbean
one did you get? Did you get San Juan or Gitmo?
I got both. Okay. I got both. When I first got there, it was only Gitmo. And then like the last year I was there, there was transitioning to more Puerto Rico, and now it's, you know, it's like 95% of the time it's staging out of Puerto Rico. So
nice. That way better deal for everyone, I think.
Oh, way better. Yeah, way better. Better.
So, well, how did Coast Guard Flight School compare to Navy Flight School? I know it's like different. Well, I know you're not like doing your initial kind of training. You're just
right,
platform
right.
specific, but what's the, right. I guess the feel, you know,
it's a lot more relaxed in the sense that, okay, we're aviators. Like we're winged aviators. We're real live, you know, pilots. We're not, you know, like students where, you know, in the, flying a T-6 or back in like the training command, you know, those instructors are trying to bite your head off, you know, just kind of like your play. It's kind of like going through boot camp.
Yeah.
Versus, you know, showing up at your first unit, like, okay, you're in, you know, you're part of this elite group now, you know, it was very relaxed. The instructors are all there to, you know, to help you. And it's like, hey, welcome to Coast Guard Aviation here. Okay. Now let me teach you the mission and, you know, teach you how to fly your aircraft. So
yeah, more,
very relaxing.
Treated more like a professional than a trainee.
Exactly. Yep. And
I got you.
And yeah, like a professional peer is how we're trained. Mm-hmm.
What was your first? What was your first mission?
Now as a fixed winger in Miami, I feel like we do a ton of uncorrelated maydays.
Yeah.
So. You know, any when I'm on a duty,
which is just anybody that called Mayday, right? And we just didn't get a fix on it. And you got to go out and look.
Exactly, exactly. So I'll listen to it, and it's just sometimes the person doesn't even say, you know, Mayday or help. It's just someone talking on channel 16, and you know, just
open mic
protocol,
right?
Yeah, yeah. So we just got to go because we don't know what's going on, you know. So I'd say I don't even remember my first. You know, my first duty night or what I got called out on, but 99% willing to bet it was an uncorrelated mayday. We go out, we'll do the search pattern, not find anything, and then come back.
And so I know like with boat stations and rotary wing stations, there's an alarm and everybody runs, right? And they, like we pause a little bit to pre-brief now, but then mostly everybody just runs. Is it the same way on the fixed wing side? Like, does the alarm sound, you guys run out to the airframe and spool it up, or how does that go?
Pretty much, yeah. So, you know, as soon as we get on duty at whatever time, let's say, you know, 3 o'clock, we'll have, you know, duty relief. And as soon as we come on duty, we'll brief the crew saying, hey, you know, it's us tonight. And just, hey, if the alarm goes off, I'll meet you at the aircraft and, you know, I'll let you guys know the details before we taxi. But pretty much, yeah. So when the alarm goes off, everyone just, you know, goes to the aircraft, get your, you know, whatever you need, whatever you require, your equipment, go to the aircraft, we'll start it up. And, we have, 30 minutes, you know, according to our flight manual, 30 minutes to, get airborne. So we try to stay within that envelope.
Yeah. And if you push 30 minutes, we're sending you back to ATTC Mobile, right? Is that, I'm just kidding.
Is it ATTC?
How's it go?
Because there is an ATTC.
What's the difference?
You
were there. Yeah, talk to us about Mobile. So Miami, a slew of uncorrelated maydays and probably a lot of flying the Florida Straits, I guess. Maybe the Caribbean, looking for contacts.
Yeah. So our LE mission was robust here in Miami for the fixed wing.
Right.
So yeah, just, you know, migrants and drugs. The fast runners, the boats, you know, we get a lot of that. Since you were Air Station Miami, we also have 65s, the dolphins out here.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a lot of the missing divers and, you know, there's tons of boaters out there, you know, all types of distress stuff. So anything that's like closer to shore, you know, the 65s would go handle. And the stuff that's a little bit further offshore, the fixed wingers, we'll go deal with those.
What's the worst conditions you ever went out in?
Oh, Hurricane.
I knew it was coming.
Hurricane approaching. Hurricane in the vicinity.
What's the max wind speed? Yeah. Do you think?
The hurricane?
No, that you guys took off in.
Oh,
or flew in. I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure how it works for you guys. I don't know where the restriction applies.
Right, the restriction would apply on the ground.
Okay.
So if it's more than 35 knots, on the ground, then flight limitations. Like we can't take off unless everything could be waived depending on the situation. And but our rule book says 35 knots on the ground. But once we take off and we're in the air, those wind speeds, I think the strongest wind I had tailwind was, maybe 90 or 100 knots.
Nice.
And it's just, the ground speed. So when the wind is, at your back, when I'm flowing, it's pushing you along, you're flying faster essentially. Because right. On the flip side, when you're going the opposite way and then boom, you have a 100 knot headwind right in your face.
You're stopped. And it's like,
yeah, we're basically hovering and we become helicopters.
That's wild. And so, were you flying on missions then, or was it like it must have been, right? Like things had to be weighed. Yeah. Yeah. Very cool.
Yeah, yeah. It's a mission. Yeah. When it's a mission, our only rule book, 3710, which is our rule book, says all we need is a quarter mile visibility. Like that's it. There's no wind restriction. Nothing. It's just quarter mile visibility, and that even that could be waved down to 00, which means basically you can't see anything outside.
Yeah.
Quarter mile visibility is basically the minimum that we need to take off on a mission. But if it's training, then our minimums are a lot higher. We need at least 2 miles of visibility and 500 foot ceilings. For the clouds.
How do you like the risk, right? The risk versus gain when the, exactly. When you're on the duty crew, when the hurricane's approaching, is the conversation any different than, a normal mission?
Absolutely. Yeah. Whenever there's weather, we have to do, a CRM and an ORM brief, an organizational risk management brief.
Mm-hmm.
And so at that point it becomes a discussion, but, realistically, it'll start from, with the pilots up front, because I'll be monitoring the weather and as will the other pilot, of course. And, if we get launched and there's weather, like here in Miami, there's always thunderstorms in the summertime.
Yeah, in the afternoon, right? Every afternoon it rains, yeah.
Yep, every afternoon, like clockwork. So there's been plenty of times where I've delayed taking off for a mission because there's a thunderstorm, right over the search area or, over our airport or near our vicinity. So, it's just like, hey, it's just, risk management, like, okay, risk versus gain here. The guy, he's, on a boat or like an uncorrelated mayday or something like that, where it's like, okay, we can delay 30 minutes. Because we can't risk the lives of, our crew.
For an open mic.
Right, yeah. Exactly. So it'd be different if there was, we call it like burning babies in the surf, like people in the water, crew, something like 100% credible, like definite, like, hey, this shrimp liner went down and the entire crew is in the water, so...
I love how that one line crosses like all communities in the Coast Guard. I think even Aton recognized burning babies in the surf.
Aton, really?
Yeah, no, I'm pretty sure. I'm pretty sure they've heard of it. That's probably the only time they respond to anything other than Aton.
Crazy. So funny.
Well, so what about Mobile, ma'am? Same kind of missions?
Mobile was, like I said, Miami is, lots of.
It's cool. That's why you're back there.
Yeah, right? Yeah. The operational time we did every mission in Miami. Everything happens in Miami. Like every bit of the Coast Guard mission that I mentioned before, the search and rescue, the law enforcement, the medevacs, and also logistics flights and Mobile. Since I was on the operational department, not the training, and not our schoolhouse. Oh, baby girl is up.
Tell her hi for us.
They say hello, Omar.
So since I was on the operational side in Mobile, it's compared to Miami, it's very sleepy.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning there's no drug boats coming up, you know, the Gulf Coast. And there's no migrants. Our mission there was more so fisheries patrol.
Mm-hmm.
You know, tons of shrimpers out there. And so occasionally we'll get, uncorrelated maydays. Those still happen because just being stationed in Mobile, our air responsibility was pretty much Tallahassee all the way out west to the Texas state line.
Oh yeah, that's huge.
Yeah, and everything up in between, like in Middle America. So, you know, Tennessee, Kansas, like everything, you know, District 8 is huge because there's just so many states, but you know, there's not too much going on in the Mississippi River that goes all the way north, you know?
Yeah, but you don't think about that. That's cool. Cool opportunity to fly somewhere different, right? Than you normally
Absolutely.
Would.
Yeah. Absolutely. And that was my favorite part. Even though I didn't get a lot of, SAR cases or missions out in Mobile, when I wasn't on a mission and they gave us the keys to the jet and said, hey, you know, go anywhere you want. Just bring her back, you know, by 8 o'clock at night. Oh man, that's, I went all up through Tennessee, Kansas, just going there for lunch or dinner and then coming back. So I really enjoyed the opportunity to fly in the Midwest.
What's your favorite airport out there?
Oh, favorite airport?
Like if you're going to pull in for lunch.
Right, right. Oh, yeah. We base the locations on the food selection.
All aviators do, I think.
I'd say the most, like my default would always be Memphis.
Okay, fair. All right.
They have good barbecue.
Yep, good choice.
But I'd say the most interesting, unique spot I went to was it was in Kansas, and it was name of the restaurant was Game, G A M E, and they just had all types of wild game on the menu. They had elk, they had kangaroo, they had like. Bison.
You guys are playing with fire, and then you get back. Then you get back up in the plane. Wow.
Oh, it was so interesting. I'm like, well, I would probably never eat this anywhere else, but you know, while in Kansas, I have to do it.
Very cool. Well, Miss Hughes, I can hear she's awake, so I don't want to keep you for too long. But let's. I know that you're involved in something called Sisters of the Skies.
Yes.
Or Sky Sisters. Yes. How do you say it? You tell me. Tell us about it.
So Sisters of the Skies. And I started this initiative because ever since I was a little girl, I started flying when I was 16 years old. So I started flying while I was in high school, and all the way up through my entire flying career from 16 years old all the way up to just my time in the Coast Guard and all throughout my Coast Guard career. I had seen a handful of women pilots, and by handful, like literally I could count on one hand and keep counting.
Right.
That's, yeah, that's the amount of female aviators that I'd run across. And, I just started a nonprofit organization. Our mission is to just increase the amount of female pilots. And, we do that through mentorship, networking, and also scholarship, because the biggest obstacle to flying for, you know, not just women, men too, it's the financial obligations. It just costs so much to fly.
Mm-hmm.
So we just try to mitigate that by, you know, first exposing young women, and not just say we're just focused on women, but you know, while I'm wearing the pilot uniform, even in the Coast Guard, I do community outreach. I go to schools, I go to career days, just so, you know, just so I could be seen out there. Cause as a little girl, I didn't even know, you know, any pilots. And, so if a young kid can see me in my uniform and, you know, they never thought it was a possibility before they saw me, you know, we kind of want to help nurture that desire to fly.
That's awesome, so, man. What age do you target?
We target 9 years old.
Oh, wow. Start them young. Yeah, heck yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, give them that career path, because there's different, you know, there's different paths. You can go the civilian route. You can go the military route. So there's a couple of different paths. So we can kind of, you know, help nurture them and guide them and provide that mentorship and also networking at a very young age. So we target 9 to 17 years old. So about 6th grade to 12th grade.
Very cool. And if anybody was interested in the program, whether they are looking for that mentorship or maybe want to help you provide some, where do they find out about it?
Absolutely. You can find out more information on our website. That's www.sistersoftheskies, all one word, and sisters is plural and as is skies, .org. And through there you can always donate. We're a nonprofit, so any little bit helps. And primarily towards scholarships, and also we put on an ACE camp every year where we actually take these young ladies flying. So any little bit helps.
That is phenomenal, ma'am. What an awesome way to kind of give back and to continue to feed that community, right?
Absolutely. I love it.
Well, Mrs. Hughes, I will let you get back to that new baby. Congratulations on the addition to the family, and thank you so much for your service to the country and for talking to us today.
Well, thank you for your service as well, and I appreciate you guys, you know, hearing my story. Just a little piece of Coast Guard history, but thanks for having me. I'm humbled.
Thank you, ma'am.
All right.
Stay healthy.
Will do.
Before we end this, we want to give a plug for some people and organizations that we believe in.
The Coast Guard Foundation supports the brave men and women of the Coast Guard when they need it the most, providing everything from financial aid to families in crisis to scholarships and playground equipment. As a nonprofit 501c3 charity, they count on our donations to deliver this support. Visit CoastGuardFoundation.org. That's CoastGuardFoundation.org to read about their programs and donate what you can to support those who guard our nation's coast.
Another one to check out is the Always Ready Collective, which delivers art by and for some daring fighters of the sea. Head over to Etsy, Facebook, or Instagram and search Always Ready Collective to check out their Coast Guard and Maritime-focused tattoo flash, pinups, and propaganda. You won't be disappointed. Anyone who gets one of their designs inked on their body will get featured on their feed and can be sent a care package on the house. Find a design you like, some blank canvas, and get it done. Thanks for taking the time to listen.
If you like what this podcast is about and what we delivered, look us up at theyhadtogooutcom or your favorite podcast platform. And like, comment, subscribe, and share so we can keep the momentum up and do bigger things going forward.
Look for a new episode every Sunday. Until then, fair winds and following seas.